Thank you for joining us at the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Please note this podcast does not intend to offer medical advice or therapeutic treatment for any medical condition for either yourself or others. If you have any medical or rehabilitation concerns for yourself or your child, please contact your physician. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the OT Corner with Mrs. K., a school-based occupational therapist bringing you a series of interviews and information on childhood development for kids with all different abilities. So get ready, get set, let's go.
Welcome back to the OT Corner with Mrs. K. I am so amazed that it's April already. I just can't believe it. I only have two more months of school left, which is crazy. We're starting the last grading period, the last 9 weeks of school, and it just always amazes me how fast the school year goes. But what's more important about April is that it is Occupational Therapy Month. This is where we celebrate OTs and all different types of settings. And, you know, OTs are not just in the school or hospital. You can find OTs working in mental health. You can find OTs owning their own businesses. There's just so many different settings that we work in, which is just awesome. You can do so much with a degree in occupational therapy. Today, I'm talking with Lori Doxey, who is another school-based occupational therapist, just like me, and we're discussing sensory processing and self-regulation. She works with kindergartners, mainly, so she works with the younger kids, and she's sharing with us today, you know, what self-regulation is and what sensory processing is and all the different tools, programs, techniques that she uses with her kiddos in the classroom. So welcome, Lori Doxey, to the OT Corner with Mrs. K with me.
Hello, Lori. Thanks so much for coming on to the OT Corner with Mrs. K. I'm really glad you're here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
No problem. Lori was actually my daughter's occupational therapist many years ago. Now she's in high school. I can't believe it. But can you give us a little background of how you became an OT and what led you to the career?
Yeah. When I was in high school and I could not figure out what I wanted to do with my life, my mom happened to get carpal tunnel and she went to go see an OT. And the person that she saw really reminded her of me, and she liked, she just liked the field, and she thought I would find it interesting. The woman actually had like an outpatient center, and she did adults and pediatrics. And I was thinking I want to do something with kids, so I went and observed her, and it was amazing. I really liked her, and that made me want to give it a try.
Now, did you end up getting your undergrad in a different degree, or did you go all the way through and get your OT degree?
No, I went all the way through and got my OT degree, and it's been so long, it was bachelor's level entry. So I went to Cleveland State and got my bachelor's there.
And that's where I went too. And I actually got a post-baccalaureate, so I tagged something onto my, my bachelor's degree, so I didn't even, because it was a long time ago too when I got mine. But and then you went right into the schools, is that what you're?
No, actually I had always wanted to do pediatrics, like I said, but even when I was in school, I knew that's where I wanted to focus. But I had several mentors or, you know, different supervisors tell me that they thought it was good to do adults first. So I actually worked for a traveling company first, which was kind of interesting. So I did a lot of skilled nursing facilities. I worked in acute rehab. I worked in outpatients. I worked at a spinal cord hospital. I worked at one point for a contract company. So I got lots of different variety of things before I did that. And I did do a few schools along the way. I've been working primarily for schools since my son was just a couple years old, because it worked so nice for the schedule is what made me really want to start doing it, and in pediatrics all the time. So I've been where I am right now. This is my 15th year.
Did you go and get a graduate degree afterward? Is that?
Yes. When I started working for the schools, you know, they pay better if you have a master's degree. So I got a master's in education. with a specification in curriculum and instruction. And then also I got my school system certification a few years ago from AOTA.
In the schools, we get a lot of referrals for kiddos for sensory processing and also for behavior issues. And it's a very blurred line sometimes. It's really hard to figure out at times what really the root of the issue is. So Lori's going to discuss with us what the difference between behavior and sensory processing is coming up next.
So Lori, what is it? I know that you're on today. You came to me and wanted to talk a lot about the sensory regulation curriculum that you use and also about sensory processing issues that we see in the classroom with kiddos. And can you just give us an idea of what the difference is between sensory processing and behavior issues? Like, what's the difference between those two, do you think?
Well, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell if a child is having their behaviors, if their sensory processing issue, or if it's behavior. Usually I can find out the difference between doing some checklists. I like to use the sensory processing measure that really helps look at what kind of sensory processing issues the teacher or the family is seeing so that you can see what might be affecting them. Because sometimes it's really hard to, check that out to figure out what the difference is, if it's sensory or if it's behavior. I actually took a course once that was called that. Is it sensory or is it behavior? But sensory processing really is more taking in all that information you're getting from the environment and trying to process it, your brain and your body being able to process it. So it can be visual or auditory, touch, smell, body awareness, proprioception, the vestibular, that balance issue. Like, different children will have different sensory processing issues. Some of those things might be difficult for them to process. I have a student right now that if there's any loud noises, you can just watch her whole body really elevate. So she wears headphones to really kind of help her with that.
And then, so what about the behavior issues? Like, what do you see when you have a kid that's more a behavior issue than a sensory processing issue?
So usually it'll be more something that's maybe attention seeking or maybe work avoidance. You know, a lot of times in a school setting, if we can't figure out what it is that is causing the behavior, our school psychologist, or we also have a behavior specialist we work with, will do a functional behavior assessment, and then they look at what the antecedents are for some of those behaviors. So does it, you know, trying to watch what the child's doing and when those behaviors happen? Are they doing it because whatever they're working on in school is just too hard, and so they're trying to avoid it? Are they having a behavior because it's they're just attention seeking? So they just want the attention, whether it's positive or negative. Or are they doing those behaviors when there's too much sensory information coming at them? And then it might be more sensory. So really that school psych sometimes really can help figure it out that way as well, like I said, in addition to those checklists.
And then the sensory processing measure that I use that too a lot. I like that there's two scales on there that I love to like look at. That's the social participation and the planning and ideas. And that doesn't have a lot to do with the sensory process. It does and doesn't in some cases, but it's interesting to me sometimes the social participation will be totally normal, but their sensory processing will be all like all wacky. It's just interesting to see those differences as well as the planning and ideas. Now, do you see any like correlation between behavior issues and those two scales on that measure?
I do sometimes. I really feel like sometimes we'll see a kid that none of the sensory stuff comes up, but those two areas are really elevated. I try to explain to parents too, like I think the planning and ideas one is really taking all that sensory information that's coming in and then using it to, you know, execute what they need to do in the day, to perform tasks, to follow directions, all that good stuff. So I think sometimes we see that, yes, they're not having a specific area that it's a problem, but overall they can't get it all together and put it in there. It's kind of more looking at that executive function piece too, and that planning and ideas. And then sometimes the social participation, I think the kids can kind of fake it a little bit and they can make it work sometimes with the social participation. But sometimes you just see a child that it might be more that social pragmatics, it might be more language, and it's not the sensory processing. So you see the social participation being hard, but it's not a sensory processing issue. So I agree. I really enjoy looking at those two areas too. I think it really helps you figure out where a child's at. And I always bring that up when we have like a team discussion about if it's sensory or behavior, because those, that really points it out for us.
And I always like too, that the, that, you know, a lot of times when you see, especially with younger kiddos, like 3 to 5 and, you know, kindergarten to third, fourth grade, their communication is not, it's maybe more difficult for them to express what they're dealing with. So that's when you see behaviors. So it's always interesting. I always look at that social participation as well. How do they get along with their peers? How do they get along with adults? And now that sensory processing measure, they have it for the 12 to 21 year olds, I think it is.
Oh,
and
nice.
There's a new, and I love it because there's a self-report form now, which is so cool. You can interview that. I love that. Yeah. So it's I like how they've expanded on that a little bit more.
As school-based occupational therapists, we are called in a lot of times to work with kids that have big emotions or sensory processing issues that are affecting their behavior. And we teach them these self-regulation techniques in order to be able to use them and be able to bring themselves down to an emotional state where they are able to attend and focus in the classroom. Lori does a really nice job of talking about some of the techniques that she uses and what it looks like in the classroom.
All right, so now, I know we talked a lot about, you know, self-regulation in schools. We work with kiddos a lot with this type of intervention. Can you go into a little bit about the self-regulation piece and like, how is it used for sensory processing issues? And can it also be used for other issues as well?
Sure. So in the school setting, really the goal is to teach a child to get their needs met so they can be successful at school. It's a little bit different with that sensory processing. So for example, you know, if they're over-registering and they're getting too much sensory information and they can't process it, what can we do to calm that down a little bit so they can better focus? And then if they're under-registering and they're not hearing things, what can we do to help them get more stimulated so they can focus and attend better? So that can really work with a lot of different things. You know, with sensory processing, we can work that way. Also, it can really help with behavior. It can help with their emotions. You know, some children can't label those emotions, and especially like you said, those 3 to 5 year olds. And if they have a communication delay, that even adds to it. So really using some of those visuals and things that we can do to help them identify their emotions so that they don't have a tantrum every time they feel a little bit of anger or frustration, that we teach them how to regulate their behavior and their sensory processing in that way.
How can it be used for an auditory issue? Like what would be an example for a kid that, like you said, with a little girl who's overstimulated by all the sounds?
Right. So we could, again, those headphones, she has headphones available to her. So we have taught her that the headphones are right here, if it starts to get too loud, you can put your headphones on. Or she's allowed to, she happens to have the intervention specialist in a connecting room right next to her. So she can just go to the room next door because she can get away from those loud noises. So teaching her to self-regulate herself so that she can own that and she can figure out a way to help herself be able to focus and meet her sensory needs.
How can, so for the behavior issues, like do you use self-regulation for different behavior issues that you will see?
Absolutely. So we do that. We will teach students, you know, if you're starting to feel frustrated or, you know, a lot of times they're just lashing out. They're not, again, they might not be getting the attention they need. They might be frustrated because they're unable to do something to the level they want to. We have a lot of kids this year for some reason that have kind of a perfectionism issue. Mm-hmm. You know, if it doesn't, this is how I picture this picture is going to look when I draw it on the paper, but I'm in kindergarten. So it's probably not going to look like a Picasso. So I need to figure out how I can let that go. So teaching them, you know, okay, take a deep breath or remove yourself from the situation. Say, I need a break. You know, sometimes that looks like a child giving a break card to someone if they can't verbalize it, or Just turning and saying to their paraprofessional or to their teacher, I need a break right now, or I'm feeling frustrated. Oh, I see you're feeling frustrated. What can I do to help you? At a younger age, that really looks more like kind of a co-regulation model, because they're just too young to be able to own that themselves. I'm sure you know many adults that don't know how to self-regulate their own emotions. So that's a lifelong journey for many people. But, you know, if sometimes I'll ask a child, I can see they are frustrated or elevated. How are you feeling? Oh, I'm happy. I'm in the green zone, because they want to feel happy and in the green zone. But I have to say to them, you know, okay, but I'm looking at you and I feel like you are feeling frustrated right now. So I show them, you know, sometimes I'll even get a mirror out and look at how your body looks right now. And then we try to provide a tool for them. Let me take a deep breath with you. Let me take you for a break. And so just providing that to begin with, and then they can start to see how they feel better after they have a break or after they take a deep breath, and what we can do to help them calm down so that eventually they can own that and provide those for themselves.
And I think that too, when we were going through the pandemic, that type of feedback was a little more difficult because we had the masks on. Mm-hmm. and understanding facial expressions. And, you know, we have a bunch of kids now that went through, you know, early childhood development that did not have a lot of facial expressions and that feedback. So it's almost like there's a delay in that type of development. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's so much, we are having such an increase in behavioral referrals in general. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm at preschool and kindergarten. So in preschool, we're seeing that from community preschools that are coming to us with behavior issues that are elevated way more than they've seen before. But again, these children that are just turning three, they were born in a hospital with mommy having a mask on. So, mm-hmm. Again, like you said, didn't get to see those facial expressions. And then when they did, the kids that are in kindergarten now, if they went to preschool, which many kids did not, because why would you subject your child and your family to all that exposure if you didn't have to? Mm-hmm. So, if they even went, probably people had masks on. And so again, they didn't learn to pick up on those nonverbals and to understand facial expressions. So, and they didn't also learn to share or to take turns, because there was not as much interaction socially as we typically have.
Yeah. And it was interesting. I had an interview with a school psychologist recently, and she was saying that the rote answers coming back, like she had this one particular kid, basically he had like rote answers that he would answer back to her as, what do you say? And he would say, thank you. And they were actually playing a game, and the phrase was supposed to be different than thank you, but because he's heard what do you say so much and it's thank you, that was his rote answer. So he didn't really have any, it was interesting though what she was talking about the reaction. So they really are delayed in some of their communication, which causes behavioral issues a lot of the time.
I completely agree. It's interesting because some of those students that we've started to evaluate, they do have a lot of that scripted speech, which, from our experience, looks kind of like someone that's autistic or on the autism exactly. spectrum, because they use those so much. But we're seeing students that as we go further with them and work on treatment, they are not on the spectrum, but they look that way when we start, because those are that's what they did to adapt to, mm-hmm. In this environment of COVID.
Lori has some really great interventions and programs that she uses in her setting, and I'm excited to actually use them myself. I'm looking into them for using in some of the school systems that I work in, because really we want to have as many tools in our toolboxes as occupational therapists. So Lori goes into some of the different programs that she uses with her kiddos, and also with educating staff and teachers in the school system she works in.
All right. So now we're going to talk a little bit about what I find interesting. I always find this interesting in different school systems. We don't work in the same school system. And I love all the different approaches that I've learned through different OTs and teachers and speech therapists and physical therapists. What kind of curriculum do you use? You talked a little bit briefly about this before we had this interview, but what do you use usually, and what age groups do you usually work with?
So right now I'm working with preschool and kindergarten. I'm at a building that that's what they have. So we primarily use, well, actually the school district I work in through middle school, they use the zones of regulation. Like everyone uses that kind of, so that's kind of what they use for their PBIS. So everyone's using that language, which is great because they use a lot of things like expected behavior and unexpected behavior versus talking about it as being good or being bad. So we use that, through the whole thing. Also, we use social thinking. I do a lot of co-teaching with speech therapists as well, especially if we're doing whole group lessons in the classroom. So I use social thinking. More recently, the last couple of years, we've started using the Little Spot of Emotion, which is a great curriculum that has lots of books and activity books that you can do that really help with the younger students, because it's, you know, zones of regulation is a great framework, but a lot of their curriculum is catered to older children. And same with social thinking. Some of it's a little bit higher level. And I'm also just started using Ninja Life Hacks, which is a different, they have a lot of books and series. Again, it's a little bit for older students, but we kind of have to bring it down a little bit. But the books are nice. Like I said before, we have so many students that have some perfectionism issues. And one of them is called like Perfect Ninja. And so it's kind of like almost a social story going through there and talking about, you know, why this is difficult and helping students to work through it. So I love to use bibliotherapy to work with our students.
Okay. And for our audience out there, what is PBIS? What does it stand for? And what is it in the school systems?
It stands for Positive Behavior Intervention and Supports. So in a school system, we want to have a framework for how everyone is addressing students' behavior in a positive way. So basically teaching ahead of time what is expected and unexpected of students. So for example, for us, we use the zones of regulation curriculum. So everyone's using that language. But right now we have pictures in the bathrooms per se, like this is the expected behavior in the bathroom. So for kindergarten students, as they're just learning to read, it's not going to be writing, but it's a lot of pictures. This is what we do. Or teaching what our expected behaviors are in the hall. We have little pictures that show what we can do in the hall, what our noise level is, for example, noise level zero. And then when you're out at recess, we talk about what are the expectations there. So just teaching the kids, having a framework to teach all the students what's expected of them so that they have that ahead of time and we can be proactive in response to behaviors.
And you had talked a little bit about how you, your collaboration, how do you deliver your self-regulation intervention with your collaborative members of your team? And who are those team members?
So in purpose of delivering instruction, my team members are really the speech therapists. I have a couple different speech therapists I work with right now that I co-teach with. Also the intervention specialists. So in our preschool setting, I go into the preschool classrooms, each preschool classroom every week for an hour. And I do some fine motor and some self-regulation. So for the self-regulation part, the speech therapist comes in and myself and the speech therapist and the intervention specialist in that room kind of co-teach a lesson every week. Usually we try to keep it 15 to 20 minutes and have some kind of movement or participation in it so that the students get what they need. And then in kindergarten, same thing. A lot of times it just depends on the IEP minutes. So for example, if I'm the only person that has that child on my caseload for IEP minutes, I'm going to teach it by myself in there, probably with the intervention specialist support and the gen ed teacher's support. And then if the speech therapist has some social pragmatic issues in that room, they'll co-teach with me in the kindergarten classroom as well.
And a lot of this is all pretty much when we go into our IEP meetings, if your child is on an IEP, a lot of the service deliveries are outlined on the IEP in one of the sections. And a lot of times, like what Lori is talking about, you know, if you have a little bit of group sessions or consultation in addition to direct services, all that stuff is outlined. So, but you had mentioned a little bit about some of the outcomes, like how are these kids responding to some of these new curriculums that you have been using?
Really well, actually. So we, you know, we have a plan for how we're going to teach each year. We adapt it each year as we go along, but then we kind of make some changes for individual students as well. So this year we have a lot of students, and again, probably back to COVID, they have no body awareness. So they'll just bump into students in the hallway. They just don't even think it's a problem to reach over and touch somebody else's hair or to, you know, touch a child. Like, they just don't think that's anything wrong with that. I think probably because they were not able to do it for so long that now they really want that. So we have really good success with the inclusion model and going into the classroom, because really when you're teaching not only the students that you have on IEPs that do have, you know, a documented disability with self-regulation or with social pragmatics or sensory processing issues, but also those peers, then those peers will call out the students. So they'll say, hey, that is unexpected. You know, they'll use that language. And obviously, you know, a peer telling a child something versus an adult telling them something is a huge difference. You know, they're really going to respond more to those peers, whereas they get a little sick of the adults telling them what to do and how to do it all the time. But they really respect and want to be accepted by their peers. So they're going to really work harder for that purpose.
And at that age, imitating, you know, kids learn through imitation. So if they have a good peer model, they're going to follow that peer model more over than they're going to probably
absolutely
follow the adult. And we find too, the physical therapist that I co-treat with, we tend to group kids in levels, like if they're in a similar level, like they all can, and if they, maybe one's a little bit better than the other, but they all really cheer each other on and they correct each other or they, you know, help each. It's really interesting. We had a session this past week where we have an older kiddo who was really protective of one of the newer students in our group. And it was so cute because usually I'm honest to God, he does act out a lot. He has some behavioral issues, but he was perfect that day. So, and just
Absolutely. Just
owning that I'm the leader and I'm going to show this younger person, is really interesting how that all worked out that day.
It really is. It's amazing if you can sometimes we'll see students that are really struggling with those skills, but if you give them that leadership role and trust them with that, they're just going to feel better about themselves. It builds that confidence, you know, that they can do better. Something else we really try to do too is introduce it. And actually, I think we're doing that in just a few weeks in the kindergarten room, and we already did that in the preschool rooms. But we try to introduce the students to a lot of the tools that we might be using in the classroom. So one way we really address sensory processing and self-regulation in the classroom is through some accommodations. So it might be flexible seating or fidget tools, or again, might just be, you know, they might have to take a break. So they might have to walk away and go to a different part in the room and kind of calm down, like a calm down corner. So what we try to do is introduce the other students in the classroom, their peers, to some of those tools and show them, this is how it makes them feel. You know, try this tool on, try on a weighted vest, try on a pressure vest, you know, to play with this fidget. And then talking about how some students need these and their tools, you know, it's not a toy, but it is a tool that might help you. You know, and what's really nice now, I feel like there's so much more acceptance of that flexible seating and the understanding that students cannot sit and get all day long. They need to be able to move. So we have so much flexible seating now. We have a lot of little rocking chairs, and we have some little scoop chairs that sit on the floor that kids can use for circle instead of someone saying crisscross applesauce and hands in your lap all day, because no one can sit like that for hours. And we also have really focused this year too on educating students about students with disabilities. So in our kindergarten this year, we have a student who is virtually nonverbal. He has Down syndrome and he's just unable to form a lot of the words and be able to be understood. So he uses an iPad. So just talking to kids, like, it's okay. You can say something to him and he understands what you're saying. He just can't verbalize back. So let him talk to you on the iPad. You can say hi to him and he can say hi on the iPad. Or teaching students about autism, so they're more accepting and understanding. You know, the more you know and the less ignorant you are about something, the more you're accepting and you want to be friends with someone, even if they are different than you. So really trying to focus on that in the classroom as well.
And they just had, I think in our school on Friday, they had a big inclusion day, everybody wore orange up at the high school. It was kind of neat. They had a big, I don't know, it was like they had all these pictures and everything. It was really neat. But they have one of the social studies class, I think they come down and they work with the kids that have needs, and they had like a big celebration. So I think that our school system, the one you work in, is they do a really nice job educating kiddos that do not have a disability or special needs about it. And it seems to be a great fit. It does. I think kids want to know. Kids are naturally curious, and it allows them to ask the questions. It allows them to understand why, you know, Bobby or Susie has got a fidget in their hand, you know, during class. Right.
And why can't I have one?
And why can't you have one? Exactly.
Yeah.
Why
am I not supposed to have one? Yeah. Right. You know, so it's interesting. The other thing too, we talked a little bit about the, who I collaborate with and co-teach with. I'm really fortunate to work with a great team of people that we meet every week with the speech therapist and myself, and there's another OT in our building right now as well. We meet every week with one preschool teacher a week, and we every week with one kindergarten teacher, and really try to collaborate about those students, which also makes a huge difference. So again, we can really cater to those students' needs when we're delivering our lessons. So, hey, and they'll just tell me the whole class is having a hard time sharing or having a hard time understanding why someone gets a tool and someone else doesn't. And so we really make sure we can address that. It's so lovely when you can work with people that really want to, you know, work together for the needs of the students. And I think that really makes a huge difference. You know, we just eat lunch together. They're my friends anyway. So we eat lunch and collaborate, and it's great. The school psych joins us. Sometimes the principal joins us. You know, it's really great.
That's excellent. And then everybody's on the same page. And it also, when you go into an IEP meeting, I mean, parents are going to see that cohesiveness, and they're going to see that teamwork. And it's very clear when you have a team that works together nicely. That's excellent that you guys do that.
Right. And then, you know, having the family on our team too, you know, if we're all using the same language and the same things, we're going to see such a better difference, you know, a better change in our students and their ability to grow.
And I think too, like, I think just, you know, I was talking to a couple of coworkers. We were trying to figure out why our caseload seemed to be getting so much bigger. And I honestly think that people are just better educated. Parents are better educated now. Doctors and pediatricians are getting more educated on what type of services are out there and what they can tie you into. It's just, it's evolving, it seems, over the past couple years. And you know, my daughter has been in the system forever, so I've kind of seen it from both sides, and I just feel like there's just more information available to all different people that are involved with your kids' care.
I completely agree. It's much better. We do get a lot. We don't see as many kids coming into kindergarten just showing up that obviously have something that they've been struggling with that no one's addressed. You know, we're starting to see that those pediatricians are educated, that they're, you know, referring to the school system earlier on, which really helps.
Yeah. And then I think parents are being, they're just, I think, more aware, like they notice the difference, they understand that there's something wrong, and that they're more apt to go out and question and ask the important questions.
Absolutely.
Which is super important. Well, Lori, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. Can you just, I'm going to be adding some of the programs that you talked about in your curriculum, that you use in your curriculum. What links are you sending me? You said you're going to send me some links on.
Yeah. I'm going to send you the Zones of Regulation link. So that really, you can go into there and you can explore their website. They really do start to teach you a little bit of the language. And some of the charts that we use. So that really helps, especially for parents if they want to use them at home. You know, we send those home for parents all the time so they can use that same language. Also, the social thinking curriculum. Again, that one's a little bit more catered to a speech therapist point of view. But again, with that language, the social thinking and zones of regulation are kind of like a sister partnership there. There's a speech therapist and an OT that knew each other that kind of worked together to make those happen. So, and then that little spot of emotion. They're really cute little books and they're great for the younger students, and those ninja life hacks for the more mature children and addressing more of those higher level ideas like perfectionism, anxiety, jealousness, growth mindset. Those kind of really address those. And those are books you could buy at home and read at home with your students as well, or your children as well.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. And I think that there's some really great information in this episode. So thanks so much, Lori.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Thanks so much to Lori and all the information that she was able to bring to this episode today. There's some really great nuggets of information, and I am including those links in the show notes. I myself am familiar with the zones of regulation, but I am not familiar with the other three, so I'm going to be checking them out myself and probably using them. Thanks again for stopping by and listening. Appreciate all the support that I've been getting. Don't forget to check me out on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Like, follow, share as much as you can. And I have some really fun things coming up this summer. I am actually teaching a Mrs. K's Fine Motor Power Hour at my local rec department, and I'm very excited about that. So I'll be giving some updates on that, how that's going. At any rate, as always, if you ever have any questions, feel free to contact me at jennifer@theotcorner.com.
Thank you for listening to the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Feel free to join the OT Corner community by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. If you have a topic you want to hear about, or if you would like to come on the show, feel free to contact Jennifer@theotcorner.com. We would love to hear from you. All information from the show is listed in the episode notes. We know you can listen to anyone, so we appreciate you stopping by. Until next time, thanks again.